The Athletic.
Totally Football Show today. Arsenal stand proudly out in front, like Tony Adams nips on Strictly. After 3-2 win over Liverpool, we ask, who looks more deadly in the boxes, Arsenal or Tony Adams? We talk Newcastle, 1 year on and Almer on, Bournemouth, from cherry bombs to cherry blossom, the Euro draw and more in this Totally Football Show. Hello there, listener, on this Monday, the 10th of October, 2022. We're joined on the Totally Show by Daniel Storey.
Morning, James.
Indeed. Jay Harris is with us as well. Hi, Jay.
Hey, James.
And, woo, from ESPN, Brazil. Brazil! Natalie Gedra. Welcome back, Natalie.
Bom dia.
Indeed so. Whatever the heck that means. You've all been busy. Far and wide around this Premier League match day 10, which is actually 9 in brackets. Felt like a weekend rich in significance. What with Arsenal doing Liverpool at the Emirates, Cristiano setting records, the Euro draw, Wrexham 7, Barnet 5. So much going on, Jay.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I spent the vast majority of my weekend travelling back and forth from Newcastle. So unfortunately, good. I was a little bit limited in what other games I did see, but I made time to watch Arsenal play Liverpool on a phone, in the back of a car, travelling down the motorway from Newcastle. And I'm very glad I went to all that effort to watch it.
Magnificent. Well, of course, we've got Daniel, who was there, will be able to explain more about that. What excuses do you want to get in early, Daniel?
No excuses this week for me.
All right. No excuses for Daniel. And Natalie, you were off at the special late night Sunday evening affair.
So that's my excuse, Everton Man United.
Boom. Well, we're going to hear about more of all of those games and probably others too. Match day 10, the big match was Arsenal-Liverpool. Arsenal laying down a marker and regularly skipping past Liverpool's in a 3-2 victory. Elsewhere, big wins for Newcastle, 5-1 against Brentford. And Man City, 4-0 against Saints. City's goal difference of plus 24 is more than any other team in the league's goals total. Oof. Palace came from behind to beat Leeds 2-1, and Bournemouth did the same against Leicester. The Cherries are now 8th. Chelsea beat Wolves 3-0. West Ham beat Fulham 3-1. There was just the one goal for Spurs at Brighton. And in the late game Sunday, Man United won 3-1 at Everton. Cristiano Ronaldo off the bench to score his 700th career club goal. United are now 5th in the Premier League, 1 point behind Chelsea in the top 4. Newcastle are 6th, 1 point behind Man United. Liverpool, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10th, and only in the top half on goal difference. Wolves, Leicester and Forest are your bottom three. Forest, though, could climb to 18th Monday night if they win at home to Villa. Exciting. Let's start with your Arsenal-Liverpool.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
These are broad shoulders. This is courage. A sporting moment in time. Bukayo Saka. Such noise!
Game-winning moment there. Serenaded by Peter Drury. Accompanying himself on the piano in that clip, which I think is a nice touch. I think his words deserve that. Daniel, you were there with the kind of arduous job of producing a match report that lived up to Peter's magnificent description there of the game-winning moment. First of all, tell us about when that penalty went in.
Yeah, weirdly watching the game, even though it finished 3-2 and it was on a knife edge, and I think there were certain moments in the game that went against Liverpool, a couple of penalty decisions and Luis Diaz's injury, certainly just at a time when he was kind of establishing himself as probably the game's best player over a period of 15-20 minutes. And yet, I never really thought that Arsenal weren't going to win the game, which is probably a huge compliment in itself, because I'm sure Arsenal supporters would say that it's often felt like the complete opposite, particularly against Liverpool. There were some really interesting moments, I thought, when Liverpool equalised both times. And sometimes at the Emirates, that can cause a kind of mass deflation and sort of groans and boos and certain players being targeted for moans. And yet, it was the opposite. There was this kind of sort of roar of, don't worry about it, with a better team, we can beat this Liverpool team. And in those moments, they were far, far better. I was interested by Liverpool's plan of kind of chaos theory of playing four up top and trying to pin players back. But it didn't really bother Arsenal when Diaz had gone off, because it just left them so much space to fly down those channels. It was a brilliant, brilliant game. And I fully believe that Arsenal needed a win like this. If they'd have won 3-0 rather than 3-2, I almost think it would have been less helpful. I think they needed to go through something like this. As Conte says, they needed to suffer. And they did suffer, and they still won, and they're still top of the league. And at some point, we probably have to start taking that a bit more seriously.
Right. Well, what a game it was. Swinging wildly from one direction to another faster than Iker Casillas' Twitter feed on Sunday. But you say Arsenal always look like they're going to win it. So they started fast. I mean, that's what they do in the Premier League. Within the first minute, Saka and Martinelli slicing that Liverpool back line open. And Nunes makes it 1-1, his first goal since the opening day. On the stroke of half-time, because Saka then goes through Liverpool's back line like butter and makes it 2-1. Firmino comes on, gets his 6th goal in 7. Brilliant goal as well. And then that penalty right at the end. Prasanna Patil says, "We're Arsenal lucky, though, to win today. Saka looked offside in the first goal." Not sure about that. "Penalty against Gabriel was not given." That was a big one. "Thiago's foul for the penalty was really soft. Could have been Arsenal 1, Liverpool 3 in an alternate universe." What do you think? Jay, did your phone allow you an ample enough view to give a verdict on that?
Yeah, it certainly did. I think that's a little bit harsh. You could definitely argue about some of those moments and the fairness of them and whether they were correct. I know there's been a little bit of a debate about the Gabriel handball, especially because we saw a slightly similar handball happen in the Newcastle-Brentford game, where it was very close to Dan Burn. But I think Dan Burn's hand was well above his head in that scenario, which is why I think that was given.
Rashford as well.
Yeah, of course. But going back to Arsenal, the last time they beat Liverpool in the league was July 2020. And over the last 2 or 3 years under Mikel Arteta, every time Liverpool faced Arsenal, I think Jota scored against them. Salah's torn them apart. So for Arsenal to come away from this, and as Daniel said, for him to never think at any one point Arsenal might lose that game, is a massive compliment to how far they've come and how well they played. I thought Martinelli he pretty much destroyed Trent in that first half. And I've seen him do that against Trent before, but the difference with Martinelli now is he's kind of got that end product that maybe he didn't have a couple of years ago. So I understand in terms of they were maybe a little bit fortunate with certain refereeing and VAR decisions, but I thought the overall performance was phenomenal.
Natalie, you liked Martinelli before it was cool.
Yes, now it's easy. Everybody, he's so trendy now, you know, and we've been having an eye on him for a very long time. But yeah, even us Brazilians are constantly surprised by Martinelli and his energy and his personality. Even in his celebrations, the way he celebrates the goals, it's like he's celebrating a World Cup winner, you know, and that really matters to him. And I can completely understand why Arsenal fans get behind him so much. And it's crazy to think that he may not go to the World Cup, even though he's doing such a brilliant season, because the competition is just so big. And Firmino is one of them. If Firmino goes, Martinelli probably doesn't go. And you have Matheus Cunha from Atletico de Madrid, and you have Pedro, who's been doing really well at Flamengo, and you have Martinelli. So it's a lot of great options. But regarding Martinelli and Arsenal, I think the way Arsenal responds to adversity is what strikes me, especially with so many young players, and I'm including especially Martinelli and Saka, because that was clear against Spurs, how they were able to control the match the whole time, even after the Spurs goal. And now with the way they reacted to both Liverpool goals, you know, Liverpool was pushing till the end. But in these circumstances, you put a team lacking confidence, Liverpool, against a team with a winning form, that's going to make a difference, especially with the early goal. So Arsenal was absolutely brilliant. And I was surprised with Klopp's selection, because he played exactly the same team that faced Rangers. But Rangers is a very different team from Arsenal. And Darwin Núñez, we have to say that he did a really good job. I spoke to him after the Champions League game, and I thought it was funny how he just sounded more confident, and he scored in the Champions League, and he said, "It's like a ketchup bottle. goals. For me, it's like ketchup. If the first one comes, the rest is going to come. Unfortunately, for Liverpool fans, the win didn't come, but the goal did.
No, but they're playing catch up now. Look at them. 10th in the league. They're 6 points off the top four. They're below Fulham. They're below Bournemouth, who they beat 9-0, of course, famously. We look to matches like this to tell us who the teams are, and we've been playing that game with Arsenal a little bit. But what does it tell us about Liverpool with Diaz out, with Trent out, with Rangers midweek and Man City after that?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I thought the 4-2-4, it's easy to say in hindsight, and as I say, the game did change in a number of instances, but it felt almost like an admission of defeat for Klopp. It felt like this was the only way we were going to play our way out of it, was by being really attacking. And I get that to an extent. What I don't get is, if you're going to do that, why you still leave Mohamed Salah, who you've just given a huge new contract to in the summer. You then leave him in a position where he was basically playing as an inverted winger who didn't really come in that much and just ended up sort of just crossing the ball for Darwin Nunes or Firmino, which is a really... I thought that was slightly sad, as was his substitution, because he looked furious when he came off. You know, managers always say that's a good thing, I want him to be like that. But to bring him off at 2-2 and then to lose the game when they put so many eggs in that Salah basket is... That is pretty worrying, because it feels like they do need to get a way for him to have more touch in the penalty box. I think he only had two last weekend. I think he had one, maybe two against Arsenal. That's just not good enough for a player of his quality.
One day we probably need to do a little thing about whether selling Salah in the summer would have been like when they sold Coutinho, which enabled them to... And that was the kind of sliding doors moment.
I fully believe it, yeah. I think selling a player at the height of their value at a certain age is still seen more by supporters than clubs, but it's seen as an admission of weakness rather than a show of strength, when actually it can be a show of strength and smart clubs have already succession planned. And it kind of felt like Liverpool had planned that succession with buying Nunes as a central striker and going to go more central. And yet they sort of did both by keeping Salah as well.
Kjetil Dvinnes says, is having Trent on the field a get-out-of-jail card for the rest of Liverpool's back line? However bad they're doing, all the criticism is going to be directed at Trent anyway. Case in point, Van Dijk has been playing like the worst version of Lovren so far this season. Part of the problem is Trent is so very visible, isn't he? Kind of overrunning constantly, like he's directed by Peter Jackson or something.
For me, it's almost become a little bit ridiculous now, because no matter what Trent does in a game, whether it's whether he's scoring a free kick or providing an assist, or whether it's something he's lacking on a defensive point, it just becomes some sort of massive conversation and massive debate. And I kind of feel for him a little bit, because all he wants to do is kind of prove himself, and, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to happen, but try and force himself into Gareth Southgate's plans. But it just becomes this massive issue anytime he does anything. And the point on Liverpool's defence is so true. You know, I think what probably summed them up is that moment at the end where Van Dijk and Alisson, there's just such a lack of communication when that ball goes over the top and it goes up for a corner. And that's the sign of a team that's lacking in confidence and doesn't really know what to do at the moment and just a bit disorganised. So it certainly can't, the blame certainly can't all be on Alexander-Arnold's shoulders.
But to be fair, Van Dijk has been very criticized as well, especially before this match. There was a lot of talk between Van Dijk and Saliba, because Saliba is doing so well. And I had Arsenal fans, friends of mine, saying, who would you buy now? If I offered you Saliba and if I offered you Van Dijk, who would you buy? And many of them were like, of course I would buy Saliba. He's younger, he has more to improve. But that wouldn't be even a conversation a couple of years ago, or even last season. Even if it was Saliba playing current football and Van Dijk playing the football he played a couple of seasons ago, because he was just in such an outstanding form. So I think the point Jay made was brilliant, that the lack of conversation between them is just, it's out there, and just Liverpool needs to figure it out, and they should have had already.
What you build with your hands, though, you knock down with your backside, says Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp. What does that mean?
Absolutely no idea. And I normally do know what Klopp's talking about, but I didn't. It does feel, and it's something we've said before, that when one thing breaks in this Liverpool team, it causes this kind of mass loss of confidence, where they think, well, everything's either going to go really, really well and we're flying, or really, really badly. And they struggle to get out of that rut. And that is, you know, that's something that Klopp has faced before. It will be really interesting if this form goes on, because it takes a huge effort from him if Liverpool finish seventh or eighth this season to think, yes, I'm going to go for this new age of Liverpool, if that's what it takes.
All right. Well, Man City coming up next weekend, Rangers midweek. Arsenal, who had 46 touches in Liverpool's box. If that sounds like a lot, well, in their previous five Premier League meetings, they had only 44. So something's going on there. They've now started the season with 8 wins from 9. The last team to do that and not win the title was Arsenal, 15 years ago. Yeah. And the team before that, Arsenal, 2004, 2005. And before that, it was Kevin Keegan's Newcastle in 95, 96. But it doesn't happen often, except if you're Arsenal. But as you say, Daniel, at some point soon, we're going to have to ask that question. The thing is, though, that with Man City in the same division, it just feels like a kind of rhetorical exercise. City, who are a point behind Arsenal still, were 4-0 winners over Southampton, becoming the first team to score at least 4 goals in 5 consecutive top-flight home games since 1963. There was lots of bants about Haaland malfunctioning and only scoring 1 goal. He's now on 15 in the Premier League this season. 23 was enough to see you crown Golden Boot last season. Southampton, meanwhile, have lost 15 of their 21 games. They didn't have a shot on target, but their fans did get to celebrate a corner that they won at a certain point of the game.
The only thing I was going to say quickly on Manchester City is that Phil Foden's now the joint third top scorer in the Premier League, which one thing the Haaland mania does is it kind of takes all of the spotlight onto one brilliant Manchester City player, and it allows those other players, I think Grealish is benefiting it from it as well, it allows them to kind of quietly get on with their work, and everyone will talk about Haaland and they'll just keep doing their thing, which obviously involves them. The relationship between Foden and Haaland is becoming really effective, almost as effective as the De Bruyne-Haaland relationship. You saw the assists for each other against Manchester United last weekend. You saw their movement together again here against Southampton. And yeah, I mean, just add that to the list of things that are worrying for every other Premier League club, I guess.
Yeah. And talking about the Haaland effect on other players, Cancelo, he was just brilliant. We got used to the way he moves, you know, cutting to the inside. But still, his skills are so impressive, and he gets more space because of Haaland as well, that he keeps getting goals and assists. And he's definitely the player that Pep speaks more during the match. Every time I'm at a Man City match, I'm surprised with that, because he's all over Cancelo during the whole match. And that shows how instrumental he is. And of course, we're talking about Haaland a lot, but the truth is, City players, they keep scoring a lot of goals. We have 8 different players who scored in the Premier League this season, besides Haaland, who scored 15 goals. You have Phil Foden with 6, and then you have other 7 players who scored. So it's just Man City doing Man City plus Haaland. So,
just wanted to jump in on Phil Foden again, because he's now got 6 goals and 3 assists in 9 appearances. And his best ever figures in the Premier League are 9 goals and 5 assists, and they were both in the last 2 seasons. So he's on course to absolutely smash his best ever record. And Haaland's obviously got 15 goals. The most Gabriel Jesus ever managed for Man City in the Premier League was 14. So just thought I'd throw that out there.
All right. Well, for all Man City's brilliance, Arsenal's still 1 point clear of them, though. How long can it last? Next up, let's talk about Natalie's trip to Goodison Park Sunday night.
If you're into your tactics and football analytics and you're looking for a deeper understanding of the game, you can join me, Ali Maxwell, along with Michael Cox and the rest of the Athletic's data team for our Football Tactics podcast. Find new episodes every week on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Ricardo Casemiro wins it back and finds a great ball for his old Real Madrid mate. It's Ronaldo. Is this the 700th? It is! Cristiano Ronaldo! Landmark goal!
Yes, Man United 2-1 winners away at Everton on Sunday night. Natalie, you were there. You were there to see the 700th club goal of Cristiano Ronaldo's career. Bless.
Yes, and he didn't start. Martial got injured in the first half, and Ronaldo showed energy and worked hard. It was a really, stats apart, it was a really positive performance from Ronaldo in terms of body language and the way he moved on the pitch. So I think Man United fans have something to be excited about in terms of what he can offer now that Martial, I don't know the extent of his injury, but Cristiano Ronaldo showed more to be more of a part of what Ten Hag and everyone is trying to achieve. And Luke Shaw started in the back after Malacia was subbed for two matches in a row. And we had Casemiro starting. And the way Casemiro bounced back from his mistake that originated Everton's goal, it's exactly what you expect from a player at his level. You know, he's the type of player that makes the defenders look good because he predicts a lot of what's happening, what's going to happen, and he knows how to read what his defense is doing and what his defense is not doing. So this is what Casemiro does well. Plus, he has this fighting spirit that is basically what you want from a defensive midfielder, and I think he can still offer more. He was brilliant, but he can still offer more because he can play even closer to the defensive line and he can show more of this leadership. I was surprised actually with him playing closer to the box at times. I don't know how comfortable he was with that, with him and Eriksen alternating. But in terms of the way he defends, he was brilliant. And I think he can be even more decisive against teams who really will press Man United, which wasn't Everton's case because they were just not good enough with the ball. They created a few chances in the end, but overall they lacked volume up front. And now they have Calvert-Lewin coming back from the injury. So maybe this will improve. But yeah, good news for Man United after a couple of very weird matches.
Ronaldo, that stat that was all over the place again on Sunday evening about Ronaldo's goal tally and what Haaland would have to do to match it, to wit, if Ronaldo never scores again and Haaland plays till he's 38, he will still need to score 43 goals a season for those next 16 years just to level Cristiano's total. Is that actually true? Like, has anyone sat down and worked it out? Because it sounds nonsense.
It is true. I mean, my initial thought when looking at it was, how long will it take if Haaland scores 60 goals a season? Because at the rate he's on, he might just do that.
Also on the score sheet, Antony with his third goal in three. Natalie, you've probably been chatting to him as well.
Yes, no, it's impressive because Antony is only 22 and he's just so confident. I had a sit down with him, a long interview at his place, actually, before the Manchester Derby. And curious enough, he's living in Paul Pogba's house. But the funny thing is there is a PP. No, I'm going to rephrase that. So funny thing is...
right. No, we. His initials. Sure.
Okay. So his initials are everywhere in the house. So right. He still needs to do some remodeling. But yeah. And with Antony, it's interesting to see how confident he is in Man United. Especially for the next season. He mentioned several times, next season our team is going to be at his best, and we're going to be very competitive. And the way he presents himself on the pitch and the confidence he shows, it really justifies why he's been scoring so much. He really believes in the project, and the fact that he knows Ten Hag so well makes him believe even more on everything that's happening at Man United, even though they were poor this week before the Everton match.
Hmm. Tell us more about Pogba's house, though, Natalie. Mm. Did you have through the keyhole or similar on Brazilian TV? Can you take us into?
Okay, so there is the pool table with big Paul Pogba initials and the chandeliers. They're very well. He's a very extravagant guy, apparently, because he has like the stairways that are shiny. I've never seen shiny stairways. With things that imitate like diamonds, you know?
Ah. On the stairways.
on the stairways. Yes, exactly. So yeah, that was quite impressive. But that's pretty much the things that I got to see.
You
from
didn't
the
get
house.
The full. No, okay.
No, I didn't get the full tour. But oh, and he has like a small football court covered. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's really nice. But I was more impressed with the stairways, to be honest.
Okay. Were there any statues of himself?
No, there weren't. But there were paintings of big, like historical black figures. So that was really cool. And yes, his initials everywhere, basically.
Well then, Man United, a point behind Chelsea, looming ominously on the edge of the top four, but then kind of over their shoulders, you've got Newcastle United, who they will be facing next week and who had a mighty win this weekend. And look at this, Jay, you were at that game.
Yeah, I was. And I think, first of all, Brentford didn't do themselves any justice. Lots of individual mistakes. David Reyes passed it straight to Callum Wilson for one goal. Ethan Pinnock passed it straight to Miguel Almiron for another of Newcastle's goals. So as good as Newcastle were, Brentford definitely handed it to them on a plate. But having said that, Bruno Guimaraes is, I don't think it's a secret, but he is just a player on another level. And my first thoughts when I'm kind of like recording the game are not even about the goals he scored. It's actually just about what he does when he's on the ball. Because, you know, you see defenders try and muscle him off the ball. You know, he just powers past them. You see people try and beat him for speed, but he's quicker than you expect. His passing range is absolutely exceptional. He's such a quality player. And the same goes for Kieran Trippier. This was actually the first time I'd ever seen Kieran Trippier live in the flesh. And I just have such a better appreciation for him as a footballer now, for what he does off the ball, as much as he does on the ball with his set pieces and things like that. There was a moment in the game where he barged Ivan Toney off the ball and then just carried the ball and made a pass. And obviously, if you put Trippier and Ivan Toney next to each other, you'd never think that Trippier would win that physical battle. So I was just really impressed by kind of just the way Newcastle played. I think St James's Park, it's always been a tricky ground to go to, but it's definitely got to be up there as one of the hardest away days now. And then the fans obviously unveiled this really strange banner ahead of kickoff. Of the Sky Sports News L shape. I've got a photo of it on my Twitter if you've not seen it. It was to commemorate 1 year. Have you not seen it, Daniel?
Yeah, I have. I'm frowning because I'm frowning.
Yeah, no, it's... yeah, so, but the banner was to commemorate 1 year since the takeover. And so it basically had, yeah, mocked Sky Sports News' is L shape. And it had photos of Amanda Staveley, Merdad Gudusi, and a few quotes and comments from reporters at the time criticising the takeover and stuff like that. So that was quite a strange moment to watch that.
Okay, but the atmosphere must have been pretty amazing. As you say, 12 months since the takeover was confirmed. So it seemed to be a pretty wild atmosphere.
Yeah, no, it was. And strangely enough, Brentford played Newcastle in Eddie Howe's first game a year ago, although Eddie Howe had COVID, so he wasn't on the bench, but certainly that day there was a, you know, real raucous atmosphere, and it was the exact same today. It was just a party in the stands. 5-1 never looked like Brentford were really going to threaten them, apart from a 10-minute period when they made it 2-1. But yeah, the atmosphere there is crazy. It's going to be a very intimidating place for other teams to go this season.
£210 million they spent on transfers in the intervening year. With Bruno Guimaraes, the biggest signing, is he going to get to go to the World Cup, Natalie?
Oh, yes, definitely. There are a lot of question marks in defence, especially in attack, but the midfield is pretty much settled with Casemiro, Fabinho, Fred, Bruno Guimaraes, Lucas Paquetá, and Felipe Coutinho. But it really impresses us the way Bruno Guimaraes developed, and he earned a lot of space in the national team, and the way he developed into this very sophisticated midfielder, because what he offers and the way he moves, and especially the way he sees the game and the way he sees the players up front moving, he's just so clever. And when you speak to him, and you always hear from players, oh, I just feel at home here, blah blah blah. He really feels at home. He's so happy in Newcastle because because he wasn't expecting to have this reception from the fans from the start. I remember going to St. James Park after 2 months he was there, and they already had a giant flag with his face. And so he wasn't expecting all of this, and he feels so embraced and so welcome, and that shows on the pitch, because he's just really comfortable doing his thing. And Newcastle is benefiting from that, and Eddie Howe knows how to take the best out of Bruno Guimarães. So it's just a success, and he's just in an European level. We talk so much about Newcastle's project, if they're going to play in Europe. He is an European player.
Hmm. Are they going to be in the Champions League next season, do you think?
I don't think they'll be in the Champions League, but watching them on Saturday, just I came away thinking it's a matter of when, not if, they eventually, you know, are challenging at the top of the table, just because, as myself and Natalie have mentioned, Bruno Guimarães is just such a quality player. You've got Kieran Trippier, you've got Sven Botman, you've got Alexander Isak. They've kind of got all those pieces to just keep going up and up and up. So I wouldn't be surprised if they maybe hovered around 6th, 7th this season.
Okay.
They've got to be considered maybe the best of the rest at this point.
Probably worth flagging up as well that it's not just the players they brought in.
Yeah.
Eddie Howe has also transformed Miguel Almiron.
Mm.
What a season he's having.
Yeah, and this was always there. This was always in the locker. It was just waiting for someone to bring it out. I thought, watching the highlights of this one, the player who impressed me, who had been kind of pilloried at Newcastle over his time there, was Jacob Murphy, who was probably... I'm not sure he'd have gotten a second Newcastle 11 at the start of last season, or if everyone was fit and if they were intending to bring in the players they have. And yet it does feel like a squad where when anyone is missing and someone has to come in, they immediately hit the ground running. I mean, literally in Murphy's case, because he drives them deep and he kind of pushes players back, and he seems to have some end product that we just haven't seen before at Newcastle. So, yeah, it feels like a squad that... It looks better than it is, and that's down to Eddie Howe, because every player that comes in, every backup player is primed, ready to try and take the place of the person they're replacing. And there's not many squads in the Premier League that can do that without the squad depth that Newcastle have, because it's not a deep squad yet. It really isn't. It's just that it feels that way because everyone stepping in makes a difference.
And it's funny you mentioned Almiron, James, because I was watching the highlights from that game and remembering when Almiron arrived. I remember Newcastle putting him to do interviews because he was so shy, and you would go and interview him and he wouldn't speak English, so I would speak in Spanish with him, and he would just, his voice was... really, you could barely hear him, and he would stare at the floor. And now you see this confident player on the pitch, just trying things, and his interviews got better, you know. So it's just a whole. He was very shy on the pitch and off the pitch, and he transformed into a very important player for Newcastle.
Well, yep, for all the other bits about their whole structure now. A pretty likeable team on the field. They've scored at least four goals now in back-to-back Premier League games against Fulham and Brentford, handing Brentford their biggest defeat of their brief Premier League history. And, as I say, they visit Man United next week, which will be interesting. Brentford licking their wounds as they returned home, the long journey back to London, where they can meet up with Romeo Beckham, I see, Jay.
Yeah, that's right. So Romeo Beckham, son of obviously England icon and legend that is David Beckham, has just been training with the B team at the moment. But from what I understand, there's no kind of sense or expectation that he might join them permanently. I think Inter Miami's season is over at the moment. So I think it's just a case of him, you know, potentially being in England for some holidays and just making sure that he keeps his fitness up at the same time. But having said that, what a story it would be if, and it's a big if, something developed further down the line.
Right, a la Christian Eriksen, perhaps.
Yes, exactly.
A brief spell before MLS starts up again next time around.
But
I should also
add, Brentford's B team now has Max Dickov, who's the son of Paul Dickov, Kyrus Lisby, who's the son of Kevin Lisby, and now Romeo Beckham's training with them. So they're clearly assembling some type of all-star sons of famous footballers team down there.
Very good. Next up, we'll talk about Chelsea... And Spurs and loads of other things as well. And that Euro draw, perhaps.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, Everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Totally Football Show European Edition is out on Tuesday, early Tuesday this week. Excitingly enough, we've got Champions League match day 4 to look forward to, the Clásica in Germany, Xavi Alonso's debut as Bayer Leverkusen manager, PSG dropping points in France, Milan Juve in Italy. And we'll probably talk about the Euro draw as well. Did you see that? England getting Italy again. Also, Ukraine. North Macedonia, so North Macedonia and Italy back in the same group. Of course, it was North Macedonia whose astonishing 1-0 win down in Palermo stopped Italy going to the playoff to get to the World Cup, and Malta in that group as well. Huh. England's toughest qualifying group in years and years and years and years, Daniel, they're saying.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that should be caveated by the fact that two teams qualify automatically and third get a playoff. But yes, it is tough, and I kind of welcome that. Although the familiarity of the opponents is slightly annoying. You know, obviously they played Italy in the Nations League as well. They played Ukraine at the Euros. They played Malta fairly recently. So that's slightly annoying as a kind of follower. But yeah, they should at least finish second in that group. There is an incentive to top it given the seedings for the Euro. You know, the actual Euro to 2024 groups as well.
Right.
So, yes, I think they will be looking to gain some revenge on Italy for one way or another, given how things have gone over the last couple of years.
As they were the other day, of course. England in a tough group because they got relegated in the Nations League, and that's why they weren't in the top pot. It does feel a bit strange having the Euros now to think about when we've still got the Nations League to finish off. That won't be till next summer. And, of course, the World Cup. So, feels like we're getting backed up a bit on our international tournaments. Meantime, just to say, Scotland are in a group with Spain, Norway, Georgia and Cyprus. Ireland, Republic of, are with Netherlands and France, Greece and Gibraltar. Wales get Croatia, Armenia, Turkey and Latvia. And Denmark are with Finland, Slovenia, Kazakhstan, Northern Ireland and San Marino. Blimey, lucky Danes. World Cup before all of that. Natalie, who are Brazil most worried about? Is it Argentina? Is it a European side? If so, which one?
I think Argentina, definitely, not only for the rivalry, but because of their results. And they've been doing a really, really good job there. France, because of the individual quality. You never really know what you're getting from France, but it's out of question how many high-quality players they have. And Spain, there's been a lot of talk about Spain and their identity and their and the job that they've been doing there as well.
All right, but that's all very polite and respectful, Natalie. But let me put it this way then. How worried should the rest of the world be about Brazil?
Okay, so I don't mean to brag, but we're very confident. honestly, we've been playing well. Neymar's having a brilliant season. Everything is gelling in the team. They believe in the manager. There's a lot of positivity around the Brazilian camp. So that's all I'm gonna say. There's an optimism with the Brazilians regarding this World Cup. Yes.
You did say earlier on, though, that there are questions about defence. And did I hear you say goalkeeper? That can't be right.
Definitely not. But yeah, in defence, it's probably the fourth option who's going to be. It's more likely to be Gabriel Magalhães from Arsenal, because the other three are pretty much settled with Éder Militão, Thiago Silva and Marquinhos. And they've been playing for Brazil for a very long time. And up front, I'm going to say the names who are definitely going to the World Cup. Neymar, Vinicius Jr., Rafinha, Antony, and Rodrigo. Rodrigo, who plays for Real Madrid. And Gabriel Jesus and Richarlison. So these are the names that are 100% confirmed. We would be very surprised if they don't go. And then you have Matheus Cunha, Firmino, Pedro, and Martinelli fighting for a spot, basically. So,
my word. All right. Was it 6 weeks to go now?
Not that we're counting, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. Ooh, quick shout for the Lionesses. who handed world champions USA their first defeat in 22 matches on Friday night in front of a massive 76,000 fans at Wembley. That was the fastest selling England game ever at the new Wembley, men's or women's. Extraordinary. England yet to lose under Serena Wiegmann. They won 21 of their 23 matches and scored 120 goals in the process. Remarkable. That match and, of course, the extraordinary situation regarding the playoffs for the World Cup will be featured heavily in the Athletic Women's Football Podcast, which is out on Tuesday. Excellent. All right, back to the Premier League. Chelsea, who have a trip to San Siro on Tuesday to face Milan, who they beat 3-0 last midweek. This weekend, putting three goals past Wolves. Anyone catch this? I really enjoyed Diego Costa doing a lap of honour mid-game with his side 2-0 down. And nobody really minded because it was Diego Costa.
Yeah, I watched this game on Saturday afternoon and there were absolutely no redeeming features from Wolves. Chelsea were not very good. Chelsea did not have to be very good. There was just nothing from Wolves. And it's amazing how quickly you can look at a team that you thought, you know, Wolves spent £120 million in the summer and just not really know what anyone's trying to do. Goncalo Guedes was taken off at half-time after producing one of the worst half performances I've seen in a long time. He was brought off for an academy kid off the bench. Matheus Nunes is trying to do things, but is sort of acting as a one-man midfield because Jao Martinho's mobility isn't brilliant. And they've got huge defensive problems. And they're starting Diego Costa up front, who may well have been a brilliant player once, but was basically only fit enough to play 10 or 15 minutes a week ago and is now starting Premier League games, which doesn't send a huge confidence boost to Hwang on the bench. I just don't know how they sort this unless they manage to hang on till January or Lopetegui manages to somehow kind of transform the mood very, very quickly. But yeah, it doesn't look good.
When are we expecting Julen Lopetegui to be confirmed as Wolves manager?
Well, it has slightly dragged on, hasn't it? And it felt like beginning of last week it was almost confirmed and they were waiting to get a trip to Stamford Bridge out the way and that not be his first game, that would be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And I don't think there's any, you know, suggestion that there's any issues with it. But yeah, they need to get him in quickly and get him working with that squad quickly because everyone just looks a bit half broken at the moment.
Just how Potter is rotating the team really well because he didn't play Aubameyang and Sterling and they managed to get a result. A brilliant goal from Pulisic, the second one. But the Diego Costa factor is always big, you know. After the match, he gave an interview to ESPN Brazil, to my colleague, to João. And he was just thanking the fans and saying how he felt appreciated at Stamford Bridge. And then he was asked, oh, okay, so, but you left here in like weird terms after an argument. And he said, no. And I quote, it wasn't with the fans. It was with the manager. What's his name again? Conte. Yes, with Conte. And I was watching it over and over again thinking, is he being ironic? And he wasn't. He actually forgot Conte's name. So that's Diego Costa for you. He's quite a character. He forgot the name of the manager who basically sacked him from Chelsea.
Wow. Sounds like when you know, someone goes through a bad breakup and they just try to completely block out that it ever happened.
Jay, do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, you're right, mate.
Wow. Well, there you go. Diego Costa and Chelsea. Antonio Conte, meanwhile, was with Spurs down at Brighton on a very difficult weekend following the sudden death of Giampiero Ventrone, which is a real shock. I mean, I don't know if anybody even knew outside kind of the immediate circle that he even had leukemia. And then for him to die so suddenly at such a young age and... Well, you're talking about this on Sunday night in our Serie A coverage on BT, the massive impact that guy had. I know he was known as the fitness coach at Spurs and a really nice guy, but fitness coach at Spurs. But his impact in Italy was so huge. He basically came in with Lippi in the mid-90s when Juve had really been in the doldrums and turned them into this machine that effectively terrorised Europe for a sort of 4 or 5 years. They only won one Champions League, but they were in the final every single year. And they were just, I mean, there are various questions. And I know what Ajax say about the 96 final, which Juve won. But they were, whatever else was going on, They were incredibly fit, incredibly well drilled. They had incredible mentality, that Juve side. And it's interesting that 10 years after that, when Italy went to the World Cup in Germany, who did Lippi bring in as his preparatore atletico? It was Giampiero Ventroni, and boom, Italy. Probably not the most technically gifted side, although they were pretty good, of that World Cup. But in the heads, there they were. Anyway, a huge loss, and obviously something that had a huge impact on Spurs and Harry Kane and Antonio Conte and Son, I think, as well. And I'm sure all of the players there. I'm not sure if that played a part in their performance on Saturday, but a 1-0 win. Any comments on this? We billed it as being potentially the most interesting game of the weekend on Thursday. Not sure if we'd give it that tagline now. What did you think, anyone?
Well, I thought what was really interesting is that Conte went for, he sort of changed the 3-4-3 to a 3-5-2, and I mean ostensibly took out an attacker for a central midfielder, which feels like a more defensive move in a team where the fans were saying this is a little bit too defensive. But actually what it meant is that Rodrigo Bentancur pushed really high up the pitch when Tottenham didn't have the ball, and they tried to be much more high pressing rather than soaking up pressure and playing on the counter. They basically ripped up the rule book and tried to play a completely different way, and it wasn't wholly successful. Brighton were able to kind of get out of that press quite a few times and created some chances, and Danny Welbeck should have scored. But I mean, they won away at Brighton, so it's a successful start of that. I wonder if this is another Antonio Conte mid-Premier League change of formation. I've accepted things aren't working, so this is the way we're going to do it now, a la the Chelsea 16-17 season.
There were the changes with Bissouma and Doherty playing, and it wasn't a great performance from Spurs, but I don't know how much we can actually take from it, given that it this emotional, and they were all very emotional. But is it a matter of us adjusting our expectations with Spurs and their level of performance? Because are we ever going to get the free-flowing football, or are we getting results and sometimes goals? Because I'm not sure anymore if we're going to get both, and if they keep finding ways to win, to which extent is this a bad thing? You know, I was just questioning myself, because I wanted them to play different because of the high-quality players they have, but they are a Conte team in essence. They're competitive, they are organized, and they're getting results. So should we be adjusting our expectations regarding Spurs?
Brighton, meanwhile, who were a bit polite once again, you kind of want them to get to the point a bit. Daniel, you did a measurement of your XG minus your actual G. 439 players. Where does Danny Welbeck rank in this? 437th. Who are the two players worse than him, by the way?
So Solly March, who was also a Brighton player, is nice. 438. And Joe Willock is 439. He's had an awful lot. I mean, should explain, that measurement basically just means how many goals, looking at the quality of chances they've had, how much are they underperforming the quality of those chances? So they've had very good chances and missed them. And Welbeck is the worst striker on that list, which, and it's more of a judge of strikers normally than any other position.
Right. Yeah.
The other thing we should say about Brighton, in really sad news this morning, is that Enoch Mwepu, their central midfielder, has had to retire because they've discovered a hereditary heart condition. So he's retiring with immediate effect, which is horrendous news for a Premier League regular, a player who was brilliant coming into the team last season and really starred in the second half of the Premier League season, and was a full Zambian international. But yeah, retiring with immediate effect, which is awful.
Wow. I mean, I'm delighted they were able to discover it, but that's
true.
Hideous
yes.
news.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll move on. Very best wishes to, well, both teams, I think, at this point. Let's have a chat next about the other games which took place in the Premier League.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
The This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Yeah, elsewhere in the Premier League, West Ham got their third straight win. Fifth win in sixth, actually, for the Hammers. That was against Fulham. Palace came from behind to beat Leeds. Leicester lost again. That's their fifth defeat in six. 2-1 at Bournemouth it was. Bournemouth, who are still unbeaten under Gary O'Neill. Lots to talk about from this game, perhaps. Not least the fact that it looks like the takeover is going ahead at the Vitality Stadium, with the Las Vegas billionaire, excitingly, Bill Foley, completing a £150 million takeover. So five games unbeaten now since they got pumped 9-0. And you recall Scott Parker went in front of the microphones and said, yeah, there's no way that this group of players can compete at this level. And look at that. Only Man City, Arsenal and Spurs have picked up more points in that time. Yikes. Not for me to draw conclusions.
No, it's the ultimate piece of selfless man management, isn't it? Like, I will motivate you to be better, but I will not be around here to see it.
As for Leicester, so much for their recovery that many had hailed after they'd beaten Forest on Monday night. They went 1-0 up, and then Billing equalised, and Ryan Christie with his first ever Premier League goal made it 2-1. Yikes. They could be back on the bottom, the Foxes, come this Monday night, if Forest win against Villa. Daniel's kind of humming and haring and not wishing to contemplate that possibility. Forest, a lot of people were expecting them to make that announcement about their manager this week, Daniel, and they did make an announcement, but it wasn't the one that many people were anticipating.
Yeah, I kind of ranked my emotions as delighted, surprised and confused in that order. I mean, from what it sounds like, I mean, there's a huge amount of noise behind the scenes at Nottingham Forest at the moment. There's a you know, if you're wanting to be harsh to our centre back, you'd say that there's too many cooks off the pitch and on. But we are in a situation at the moment where it sounds like there was a kind of, I don't know, a big tete-a-tete with everyone where they thrashed everything out, and it was decided that they should keep faith in Steve Cooper rather than looking for managers. As I understand it, they had seriously considered, you know, they'd gone down some way down the road of seriously considering replacing Cooper. I think the fan reaction made a huge difference. They continued to sing his name against Leicester. He's a very popular man for obvious reasons. They also suspect, those supporters, that he's probably covered up a multitude of conflicting opinions behind the scenes that have you know, sadly have come to the surface over the summer and at the start of the season. So, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that in 3 weeks' time there are still people at that club that we think will be there that won't be there then, because who knows with Forest? And it obviously has to rely on league form as well. They need to win a game soon.
Mm. Yeah, it'd be good, wouldn't it? All right, Villa is the next opportunity on Monday. All right, well, what about Crystal Palace and what was only their second Premier League win of the season, 2-1 against Leeds, and West Ham, and that 3-1 over Fulham, Natalie?
Yeah, a lot of things happened there that made Marco Silva very unhappy with decisions. Scamacca's goal was a weird one because he didn't even celebrate, and the VAR couldn't find conclusive evidence of the handball. And the penalty from Andreas was very immature from him. But even so, Marcos was losing it, absolutely losing it. And Antonio's goal with the handball at the play, and it was all very frustrating from Fulham's perspective. But it was actually the first time since January West Ham won back-to-back Premier League games, which was something that I thought was very surprising and positives for West Ham, apart from all the VAR discussion and everything. It was Paquetá's best game so far. He did really well, and I had a sit down with him last week at the club, and he said some very why are you guys doing this
sounds like you,
I mean the... your social diary, Natalie, is
there a massive
it's
club
like
of
speed
footballers
dating
meet
yeah yeah it's like speed dating with Natalie. You sit there and they file past, I think, is it?
There are a lot of Brazilians in the Premier League, you know, they keep us busy. Right. So I've been working a lot, and it's the World Cup is like 6 weeks away. So they
that's
they
true.
Want
who
to
are
talk.
You talking to this yes. week, Natalie?
You know, this week's a quiet one. Actually, I was supposed to talk to Richarlison, but it's my birthday, so the other reporter is doing that
today, Natalie.
No. It's Thursday. Thursday. So I was supposed
Thursday,
to do
okay,
Richarlison on Thursday. Yes. Okay. But anyway, wow. back to Paquetá and not my birthday. Yep. He feels much more adapted in terms of physicality. And he said something about the training that when he first arrived, he was like, God, these training sessions are very long. And now he's, okay, so 2 hours, I'm fine. I'm feeling okay. He's dealing much better with it. And he's supposed to be playing next to the box because with the national team, he plays in different roles. And that's very good for West Ham because he can play more defensive role, like defensive midfielder. He can play wider, but David Moyes told him, okay, just approach the front players and approach the attackers, and he's been doing this really well, and he did this really well against Fulham as well. But he's very anxious about scoring because he gave an assist in this match, but he really wants to score. And in Brazil, his celebration is very famous. It's like a little dance. I know all Latins, they dance, and a lot of people don't like it, but we completely embrace it. And actually, the West Ham players were asking him, like, can you teach us the dance? So I'm very much looking forward to the moment where he's just teaching the dance to the West Ham players.
Brilliant. Excellent. All right. The other game that took place at the weekend was Palace going behind at home to Leeds, but roaring back for their second Premier League win of the season. The winner scored a wonderful goal by Eberechi Eze.
Yeah, I think Leeds are in a bit of a pickle at the moment. Jesse Marsh after the game was saying, we deserve more than 2 points from our last five games, and kind of agree to disagree on that. But the fact is that Leeds are bad at certain things, and they seem to be repeatedly exposing those flaws. So, for example, they concede loads of goals from set pieces, and yet you constantly see like central defenders just steaming out wide and committing fouls, which then means, as in this game, Leon Cooper commits a foul, free kick comes into the box, they don't mark properly, and they concede. And you can't afford to do those things when, you know, Patrick Bamford's still rusty. They're not scoring that many goals. Yeah, things have just taken a downturn. That win against Chelsea feels a long time ago, put it that way.
Well, that was the Premier League weekend. We've got Champions League, Europa League and Europa Conference League on the way in the next few days. Natalie, you've got a quiet week and then your birthday. Hopefully you'll be getting some paquetas for that. That's on Thursday at Engedra. What are you up to, Daniel, this week?
I'm going on holiday on Thursday for a week.
What?
To the Isles of Scilly, which I'm looking forward to. My kind of pre-World Cup week off before 5 weeks in Doha.
Brilliant. Excellent. And Jay, what have you got up on The Athletic?
A couple of weeks ago, I have to mention, finally tracked down after several weeks of searching Conor Maseko, who is better known as that goalkeeper who was sent off in a FA Cup qualifying match for urinating in a bush. I'd have to say fair play to him because he's taken it in his stride. I'm sure there's a pun that someone can work into there better than I can. But he was really up for laughing about it. But what struck me the most is that he said there was not a single point I thought I'd get sent off. He was like, I thought the most I might get is a yellow card for time wasting. But for context, the ball had gone out for a goal kick and there's maybe a patch of bushes 20 yards behind his goal. So this is non-league. There's no ball boys. So he had to run and go and collect the ball. And there's actually footage of this. You can see him kind of do a little peek over both shoulders. Decides to do his business in the bush. And then he gets stitched up by the opposition players who all point it out to the referee and the linesman. And then they all wait for him to finish. He bowls over and the referee sends him off. And the official reason in the referee's report was for inappropriate or offensive behaviour. But then Conor Maseko told me that the referee told him, oh, if you'd asked, I wouldn't have sent you off. So a perfect non-league story for you. It's got a little bit of everything.
I needed to go for most of the game, Conor told Jay. I forgot to go at half time because I was so involved with the team talk and I didn't want to step away. I can just imagine how hellish that must have been for him, shifting uncomfortably from one foot to another between the posts through that second half.
And that's the point I made to him, because it was a big FA Cup at that level, to progress quite far in the FA Cup qualifying and have any type of hope of getting to the main draw is huge. And they were playing a team, Shepton Mallet, who I think had won 7 games in a row. So I said, do you think that was just an element of that pressure, and almost you were concentrating for so much in the game, you almost needed a minute to do your business and almost calm down. And he said, I hadn't thought of it like that, but that very much could have been the case. I was just concentrating so much on playing well. And his manager said, had you not been sent off, you probably would have been the man of the match. So, but they drew that game 0-0, but then they lost the replay, unfortunately.
Do you guys remember when Ronaldo Fenomeno did it? But he did it, he did it with the ball. He placed the ball. He sat on the pitch and placed the ball. And we just had a laugh about it. No one got a card or anything. Come on.
Mind you, he was Ronaldinho Fenomeno. Yeah. All right, well, there you go. That was Blackfield and Langley's number one getting booked for his number one. And our second PP story of the day. So there you go. We'll wrap it up there for this Totally Football Show. Many, many thanks to Jay, Natalie and Daniel, producer Charlie, and you, listener, you. We're back on Thursday with our reaction to all the midweek stuff, which, of course, we'll be previewing, as I say, early Tuesday with James, Jules, Rafa and Alvaro. So anyway, do drop in on us whenever you fancy, and have a great time in the meanwhile. Cheerio.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.